Welcome to Thriving. I'm your host, Wayne Visser, and joining me is Hanan Chaluki. She is the founder of Inclusified, and we're going to talk about all things diversity and inclusion. It's an interesting conversation, so let's get straight to it. Welcome, Hanan, to the Thriving podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hanan, you are working in the area of inclusion. And for those that are familiar with my book and the Six Great Transitions, they will know that one of the biggest transitions we have to make is from disparity, inequality, discrimination, all of those issues, to what I call responsibility in an access economy, and access in the sense of inclusion. So we're going to dig into that topic now, since this is what you've focused on. And I'd like to start by asking you, what is inclusion for you and why is it such an issue?
Inclusion for me is about setting things straight, meaning that we have lots of groups of people in society, lots of communities who are marginalized, who don't have equal access to opportunities, who don't feel engaged in society, who don't feel that they belong to an organization, for example, whether it is the workplace or a social organization. And when I mean setting things straight, it means, you know, making sure that the access is there, but also making sure that people actually feel included. And there's a big difference between the two, because sometimes the access is there and you could say, you know, we have all these vacancies in our organization. Everybody can apply to a job, but there are certain mechanisms that make sure that it's only certain people that apply, that there a lot of people are actually excluded. So when I mean inclusion is setting things straight, it means that it should actually be an engagement from an organization, from society, from people to make sure that the access is there, but also in practice, in reality, that everybody feels that they have a right to say something, they have a right to enter an organization, and that they actually use that right. Because there's a big difference between just creating the access, but making sure that people actually, you know, take steps and do something to make use of that access.
Yeah. That's so important. So it's not just about the numbers. It's not just about saying we have X number of vacancies or X yes. number of people or this proportion. It reminds me actually of an experience I had when I was with KPMG in Cape Town in South Africa. And, you know, there we have quite a big Muslim population. And they were also in the workforce, in the workplace. But in conversation one day, one of them said to me, you know, of course, we're in the organization, but we don't always feel so comfortable. One of the reasons is every time we have a work get together, everybody's drinking. we don't drink alcohol, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not that anybody was forcing them, but yes. it's just that whether it's a feeling of comfort and of being welcome and of also being respected in beliefs, and there are so many elements. So
yes.
I guess this is what you're talking about, is having a welcoming or an accessible culture.
Yes, definitely. Culture is a big part of it. You know, part of it are just the processes. You know, I'm sure that the Muslims within the organization were invited to all the get-togethers and all the parties. So all the processes were there. But the culture shift is a lot harder, because you can have a culture of drinking alcohol, for example, but you can also have a toxic culture that really puts a pressure on people to drink alcohol. There are lots of variations, obviously, and it's not just about the social gathering within an organization. It's also about, for example, meeting cultures. I know that I had a call not too long ago with a company that I work with, And I remember saying, you know, they were like, yeah, but we have diversity in our company. Like all of our meetings are usually quite diverse. There are always people of color there. There are enough women there. So like they checked all the boxes, but I asked them like, who is talking most of the time during your meetings? Is it only the same people that are always talking? Is it only white people? Is it only men? Is it only people who identify a certain way? And then, you know, there was a little bit of silence because they never thought about it that way. It was just like the presence is there. So how come that's not enough? And usually culture is something that isn't always very outspoken. And it's really difficult to figure out what is happening or why it's going wrong when nobody talks about it. So as you said, like your example, if a Muslim says, you know, I don't always feel comfortable with the social gathering because everybody's always drinking, that's actually something positive because they feel like they can address it or they can share it. But a lot of companies and organizations don't have that culture. There's a lot of silence on the topics that actually matter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting. And it reminds me of another anecdote, if you like. So in African culture, I was born in Zimbabwe, I grew up in South Africa. And I think we're missing still that element of listening. Yeah, so the way that our traditionally white European culture is that, especially in a corporate context, you speak up, right? You
Yes.
are confident, you look people in the eye, you even interrupt, you know, to make your point. And in African culture, traditionally, of course it's changing, but looking somebody in the eye is actually disrespectful. So you keep your eyes lowered, especially if it's somebody senior.
Yes.
And so, of course, you will let the more senior person or the louder person just speak and you won't interrupt. Now, that's a little bit of a stereotype. And of course, things are changing. But it's an illustration of this point that listening seems to be as important as simply giving people a place at the table.
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the issues we have, especially in corporate cultures, like westernized corporate cultures, is that often we listen to reply. We listen to people and we're already thinking about, okay, what can I say back to them? But we're not actually listening. We're not actually taking in the information, the emotions that people are communicating. So it creates a disbalance. Because the person who is talking is just talking to reply. The other person is talking to reply, is listening to reply, and nobody's actually listening to understand what the other person is saying. And of course, there are cultures where those things are different. You know, sometimes we might stereotype them, but other times it is a fact that every culture has its own way of communicating. And it's very recognizable when you say like lower your gaze and listen and have respect for people from senior functions. To give an example, I grew up in Belgium. I have a Moroccan background. I grew up in a Muslim household. I am practicing Muslim today. And I remember that if something would happen at school, for example, I didn't feel like I was treated justly by a teacher or somebody in a certain function, then it was very difficult for me to talk about it with my parents because my parents would reply with, they are your teachers and you just have to listen to them. And it doesn't really matter what they are saying. And if something happened, then you just have to get over it and respect people in a certain position. So there are a lot of elements decided by, you know, the way you grew up and the part of the world in which you grew up. But it has an impact on how inclusive that communication is, whether it's at school or at work or in any other situation.
Yeah, we have at Antwerp Management School, where I'm professor, a course which we call Global Leadership Skills. And there are three components. One is self-awareness. One is societal consciousness, and the third is what we call global perspectives, which is a lot about whether you're able to be on a multicultural team and work together, you know, understand the different approaches, the different cultures, the different behaviors, and still get to a position of performance, which of course is what the challenge is for workplaces all around the world now. And we want the diversity, but it's not a case of just having a diverse team or a diverse workforce and then saying, well, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to just work automatically. We have to work on it because we bring our different perspectives and we bring our different approaches.
Yes. And I think what you're saying is very true. Like, people want that diverse workforce, and because we are going to be more productive, more creative, and so on. But people forget why those teams are more productive, more creative, and have different perspectives. It's because they also, they become very good at overcoming certain challenges that come with the diversity. That means if you have a diverse workforce, you're often going to have a lot more discussions internally because people are sitting there from different perspectives, and being able to have those conversations and overcome differences and, you know, finding mutual ground, finding solutions together, that is what makes a diverse team a better team. It's not just having people with different backgrounds around the table. It is how they communicate with each other and how they work together and how they can overcome certain challenges. But that's usually something that people do not like to hear, because that takes a lot of work and a lot of courage, a lot of awkward conversations, a lot of compromises. And it's a lot more difficult to do that than just to get those people around the table.
Yes, and I think we are in a stage of our global history where we're challenged because there is more uncertainty. And what we can see now in behavior around the world, political behavior especially, is that in times of uncertainty, people go tribal. And by that, I mean people look for others like themselves that they can cluster together, that gives them security, that, you know, reinforces the way that they think, what they believe. And that's a coping strategy for dealing with uncertainty. But it also takes us backwards, I think, because we've had years now of internationalizing, of globalizing, of starting to embrace diversity, especially if you look at cities, but also global companies. And yet we're at this moment where we see the opposite happening. We see conservatism really, you know, rearing its head, nationalism, and essentially tribalism, I like to call it. And that's a challenge. It makes it difficult, right?
Yeah, it makes it very difficult because it is a mechanism. It's a very human coping mechanism. But in a world that is super diverse, as you said, we've had decades, we've had centuries of migration patterns, of digitalization. We identify with people that live across the globe, and we communicate with people from everywhere. So in society today, it could be quite dangerous and definitely when it comes to politics, because there are always people in politics who find this, you know, there are lots of opportunities in nationalism and in people wanting to stay with their own tribe, as you would define it. But I don't believe that this is the way to move forward, because we're past that. We don't consist of countries or communities of people that all look alike. And I think it's dangerous to want to go back in time, because it's going to disappoint, obviously. But it's also going to create lots of tensions and, you know, put people against each other where it isn't necessary at all. But of course, for political motives, it can always be interesting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned migration, because the fact of the matter is we're all migrants.
I mean, of course.
Yeah, there are very few people in the world that can say, you know, throughout history that they haven't migrated or don't have ancestors who have migrated. And so even the tribal notion is a little artificial, because we've all been mixing throughout history, and it's a question of recognizing that. I remember a little scientific experiment that was done, and I can't place exactly who had done it, but where they got people who looked very different to come and sit together, and, you know, they discussed their differences. And then afterwards, they revealed their DNA tests.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And showed that actually they were, you know, they had all these elements of mixture in their DNA. And it surprised and shocked people who thought they were somehow purely this or purely that. But let me bring it a little down to practice now and the workplace. I think you work with some organizations. So what do you see as best practices here? What are companies doing right? Where do you see the progress?
I think what companies are doing right is having conversations that are quite necessary, but that have usually been ignored, which means that for the first time, I see a lot of companies that are collecting data, very important data, not by surveys, but by focus groups in qualitative ways to understand how people are feeling within their company, but also why they are feeling a certain way. And, you know, the collecting data part to me is very important, because what I used to see was that people would just, you know, follow their gut feeling. I feel like all Muslims feel quite well in this organization. I feel like women don't mind doing this or that within our company. But when you actually have those conversations and you get real raw data by talking to people, that can lead to very different insights, very surprising insights. And I think that that's usually where it starts, by having those conversations and finding out how people actually feel within the company, but also what they feel like, what is inclusion to them? Do they feel that inclusion is working from home five days a week? Or do they feel like, no, we actually need an office space. We need to go somewhere at the beginning of the day. So I think that the collecting data part is quite important. What I also see is that, especially during the pandemic, we suddenly saw that a lot of things were possible. There are certain companies that found it very difficult, the working from home part, but also like doing virtual meetings, communicating a lot through emails and not only face to face. So there are certain companies that had to overcome their anxiety and their fear of doing things a certain way. And I think one of the things that we've learned is that there's no such thing as one size fits all. So there's a lot more flexibility within a lot of companies, which I think is very positive, because if you live 5 minutes from work or 50 minutes from work, your working reality, the time you spend going back and forth is very different. Your family status can have an impact on that. If you have small children at home, if you are single, if you are living with your parents and sharing a house with five siblings. So those are all very different realities. And I think that one of the things that I really liked is that we've all become a lot more flexible. Many companies have become more flexible to try new things, to try new ways of working that are a lot more inclusive towards certain people, certain minorities, and so on. So those are definitely two things that I've seen in the past couple of years that I think can have lots of positive consequences.
Yeah. And I love that you're talking about data, but qualitative data, because I think often organizations get hung up on the quantitative data.
Yes.
Especially their profile or their mix of workforce, and they may have targets on that, which are important. But, you know, to capture those conversations, it reminds me of something we do within the GRLI, which is the Globally Responsible Leadership Initiative. I'm on the board, and we have what we call courageous conversations. And this was something that was picked up actually by companies like BASF and Apple after the Black Lives Matter movement really took off in the US, was to hold these spaces to have difficult conversations. And you know, it strikes me that in companies especially, we're always so busy and we're always all about the work, right? If we have a meeting, it's got to be a productive meeting. It's got to be with output. And so just holding those spaces for people to talk about the difficult things, I think that's really critical.
Yes, definitely. And I think that the problem with only having quantitative data is that it is quite misleading very often. Like you can say I have 20% women in leadership positions, but when you look at the reality, they do have 20% women in leadership positions, but their way of leading, for example, could be quite masculine because they feel like to integrate within the company, I have to adapt my leadership style to a very masculine way of leading. So yes, you have many women in leadership positions, but that doesn't mean you have lots of feminine leadership. And those are things that you can analyze in conversations, but you can't analyze it simply by saying, okay, we have that many women in that position. And I do believe that having those courageous conversations can definitely make a difference.
Yeah. And you also are saying that there are very practical things we can do, like having more flexibility. And by being more flexible, you allow more inclusion because not everybody works in the same way or has the same schedule. They have other responsibilities, perhaps family responsibilities, or and I think this is an example of how we can make it easier for people. Sometimes I think it's about opening a door rather than forcing people to be included, right? It's making it easy. I remember a conversation I had with Muhammad Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank, and he was talking about poverty, and he was saying, you know, we often talk about lifting people out of poverty, but in fact, poverty is like a cage, and you just need to open the door. If you open the door, people will get themselves out of poverty. You need to create an enabling environment. And I guess that's what you're talking about as well for all kinds of inclusion.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. It is about just creating certain possibilities and giving people a way out of them.
Yeah. Now, I guess with inclusion, we're talking about lots of different kinds of inclusion or diversity in many different ways. So we talked implicitly, I think, about ethnic inclusion. We've talked about gender inclusion. There are others, right?
Yes.
On the sort of spectrum of abilities, people with physical or perhaps mental disabilities. There's this lovely term, neurodiversity, which I really think is a fantastic way of talking about people with different kinds of abilities. So I guess we have to find ways for that kind of inclusion as well.
Definitely. I've learned that some companies find it easier to talk about certain types of diversity and a lot more difficult to talk about other types of diversity. And I see this trend where, you know, gender is always like number one. Like, you know, everything is about feminism, it's about gender equality, and I'm a huge feminist myself, and I definitely believe that it's necessary. But because we forget the fact that a lot of it should be viewed from an intersectional point of view, many people are still excluded. For example, when we talk about gender, we usually talk about white women. And when we talk about people with a disability, we usually talk about people with a physical disability. It's a lot more difficult to talk about neurodiversity and creating environments for people that are, for example, more introverted or have a different way of perceiving a certain reality. And the visible is always a lot easier to tackle than that which is invisible. And I believe that those are things where companies are definitely struggling. And everybody during Pride Month, every company likes to hang out a rainbow flag, and it's a very easy initiative. But to talk about mental illnesses, for example, that's usually, there's more taboo there.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation I had just in this past week where a colleague from South Africa was saying how interesting and frustrating it was that the diversity agenda, of course, has come to include women, but exactly to your point, somehow having more women, which can often mean white women, has somehow gone ahead of the queue as compared to, say, more ethnic diversity in workplaces in South Africa, for example. So we really have to pay attention to these issues. There's some research I sometimes show, which every time I do, it just stuns me. It's a survey about different countries, and the question in the survey was, would you like more gender diversity or gender equality and more ethnic diversity? Now, firstly, it's inconceivable to me that there are places where people don't want more gender equality, but really some it's very low. And then even more stunning to me is that even in those countries where they want gender equality, some of which are, you know, European, Scandinavian, they don't necessarily want more ethnic diversity.
Yes.
You know, so there's a real lack of understanding that how crucial this is and how positive, how beneficial this really is to embrace diversity.
Yes. And I think that the reason that people sometimes reply to these questions in a certain way is they choose diversity that they perceive as easy. You know, having a woman, a white woman extra in our team is not something that we're going to have to change a lot for. But whoa, ethnic diversity, we have to start understanding other cultures now. It might require more, and it scares people off. Easy. People are afraid of what they don't know or don't recognize or don't see as something that has a certain proximity to their own environment. Some people like to choose a more easy type of diversity.
Yeah. We're coming to a close now, so I'd like to ask you, what is it that gives you the most hope working in this area of inclusion? Clearly, we have a long way to go on many
Yes.
of the issues, but where do you see the glimmers of light? Where do you see the real progress being made?
There is definitely a long way to go, but I am hopeful because I see small steps taken, and I am a fond believer that small step can definitely lead to big changes. And I'm doing this for almost 9 years now. And I know, for example, that when I just started out, it was very difficult to talk about diversity in certain environments, and that people would usually still ask me, like, why is this important or why should we invest in this? And today I don't have to explain that anymore. So that in itself is already a big change to me, that people do see the value of diversity, but often they just don't know how to get there. And I hope that I myself, but also others in the field, can help companies and organizations to make it more practical, to hand out tools and expertise to actually create those changes in the long term. But I think that what keeps me going is progress. Even if it's very small, I believe that there is definitely progress.
Yeah, and I think that's true also of sustainability more generally. We've
Yes.
gone, for the most part, beyond having to convince people that it's important, that we need to make progress. It's now about the how, and it's about moving to action. And,
Yes.
You know, it's good to see that certainly many companies are wanting to take action, are looking for support and guidance, and are moving on it. So thank you so much for spending a little time with us today and sharing your insights and all the best.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. The poem of mine I'd like to end with this time is a short poem which hopefully gets to the essence of what we've been talking about. It's called Not What You See. I am not what you see, whether ugly or beautiful, fabulous or forgettable in your eyes. This visage is a mirage, a mishmash of random genes, a splish-splash of changing scenes, a laughable disguise. I am not what I seem, whether strong or pathetic, uninteresting, or magnetic in your unseeing. This mystery is a history, a storm form of wild schemes, a whirl swirl of bright dreams, a brilliant being. Well, that's all for this week. I'm glad you could come along for the ride. Next time, I'll be speaking to Anil Kumar Ambavaram, and he is, among other things, the founding director of the Reset Cotton Program, where RESET stands for Regenerate the Environment, Society and Economy through Textiles. I'm sure you're going to find that one interesting, so look forward to having you along then. In the meanwhile, have a thriving week.